From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dennis Leary. He first became known for his manic and cynical comedy on MTV and in his show No Cure for Cancer. His films include The Ref, Wag the Dog, and The Thomas Crown Affair. Leary is now starring in the ABC detective comedy series The Job. Next week's episode may be the final one. Leary isn't sure if the series will be renewed. Also, writer Daniel Harris, his new book, A Memoir of No One in Particular, probes the banalities of daily life. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the Sonics, an early punk band out of Seattle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An Amtrak train has derailed in Florida, leaving dozens of people trapped in overturned rail cars. A sheriff's dispatcher in Crescent City said the train was carrying passengers and vehicles from Sanford, Florida, to Lorton, Virginia, near Washington, D.C. Representative John Micah, a Republican congressman from Florida, said National Transportation Safety Board officials told him there were at least three deaths. That report hasn't been confirmed. The dispatcher said the train was carrying more than 400 passengers when it went off the tracks about 60 miles north of Orlando. A small plane crashed into a skyscraper in the Italian city of Milan today. The crash initially raised fears of a terrorist attack, but Italian officials say it was an accident. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
The crash scene was ominously familiar, clouds of smoke billowing out of a high-rise building into clear blue skies, a gaping hole at the 25th floor. On the street, firemen and rescue workers helping the injured. But Interior Minister Claudio Scajola said initial information indicates the cause was an accident. The small Piper plane had taken off from the airport in the Swiss city of Locarno, 50 miles north of Milan. The pilot sent out a distress call just before the crash, citing engine problems. The 30-story building, known as the Pirelli Tower, is a Milan landmark. Built in 1958 and designed by the architects Gio Ponti and Pierluigi Nervi, it's Italy's tallest building, and it houses the Lombardy regional government. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
Canadian politicians are raising questions about how their troops were killed in an apparent friendly fire incident today in Afghanistan. The Canadian troops were serving under U.S. command. Karen Kelly reports from Ottawa.
24 Canadian soldiers are fighting alongside Americans in the military campaign in Afghanistan. Eight of those soldiers were killed and 13 seriously wounded when a U.S. fighter jet mistakenly dropped two bombs on them. The accident has renewed concerns about Canadians serving under American commanders. Progressive Conservative leader Joe Clark questioned whether the troops are safe.
Did the arrangement whereby American commanders direct Canadian troops have any impact on these casualties? Was there any incompatibility between the communications systems of our troops on the ground and the aircraft involved in the incident?
Both the Canadian and American governments are investigating the incident. For NPR News, I'm Karen Kelly in Ottawa.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points to close at 10,205. Declining issues led advances in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 8 points. It closed at 1,802. The Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index lost a little over a point. It closed at 1,124. This is NPR News. Merrill Lynch & Company says it has agreed to disclose more information about its connections with businesses that are the subject of its research reports. The agreement came after New York's attorney general accused the giant brokerage firm of biasing its research in favor of companies that were current or potential clients of its investment banking business. Merrill Lynch said it's still discussing the details of the agreement with New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Talks aimed at settling the criminal charge against Arthur Andersen broke off today. Justice Department officials say they're ready to proceed with a trial against the accounting firm for its role in the Enron scandal. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Andersen's lawyers had been meeting with Justice Department officials in recent weeks, trying to find a way to keep the case against it from moving to trial. While the two sides came close to a settlement, the talks ultimately collapsed. One major sticking point was said to involve the firm's admission of culpability in the scandal and whether top executives knew that Enron-related documents were being shredded. With the talks over, Anderson is scheduled to go on trial on May 6th. The end of the talks raises new questions about Anderson's long-term survival. Not only has the firm lost some of its biggest clients, it's also watched its global network fall apart, and rivals are moving in on its domestic auditing business. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
The former king of Afghanistan arrived in Kabul today after nearly 30 years in exile. Mohammad Zahir Shah made a national television address saying that he wants to serve the people. The 87-year-old former king will live in Kabul as a private citizen, but supporters hope he'll be a force for national unity. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo and its 130,000 employees, working to end hunger by donating food and serving meals in their local communities, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actor and comic Dennis Leary.
I'm not happy. Nobody's happy, okay? Happiness comes in small doses, folks. It's a cigarette or a chocolate chip cookie or a five-second orgasm. That's it, okay? You come, you eat the cookie, you smoke the butt, you go to sleep, you get up in the morning and go to f***ing work, okay? That is it. End of f***ing list.
That's typical of the manic cynicism in Dennis Leary's comedy. We heard a clip of his stand-up show, No Cure for Cancer. He did a follow-up called Lock and Load. A lot of his fans were introduced to him through his short comedy breaks on MTV. Comedy helped him launch his acting career. His films include The Ref, Wag the Dog, and The Thomas Crown Affair. Leary co-created and stars in the ABC detective comedy The Job. The final episode of the season will be shown next week. It may or may not make it back next season. Leary plays a detective who does good work, but he smokes too much, drinks too much, and cheats on his wife. In this scene, he's worried that his girlfriend is cheating on him. His partner, played by Bill Nunn, suspects something's wrong.
Come on, man, what's up?
I don't know, man. I think she might have a guy on the side.
Well, you don't have a wife on the side.
No. I have a wife. I don't have a wife on the side. I have a wife.
With a girlfriend on the side. So why shouldn't your girlfriend on the side have a guy on the side?
Because that's not how it works, okay? If she has a guy on the side, that means she'd be lying to me, and we don't lie to each other.
Oh, you don't lie?
No, Tony knew about my wife right from the very start.
Well, if you don't lie, how come your wife doesn't know about your girlfriend?
I didn't say anything about not lying to my wife, okay? Me and Tony, you know, it's a different story.
Oh, I see. So it's okay to lie to your wife, just not your girlfriend.
Right. Hey, look, if I can't trust the woman I'm cheating with, then who can I trust?
I don't know, man. Satan?
Dennis Leary, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe in your words your character in The Job.
My character is Mike McNeil, who is based, fictionally presented, but based on an actual friend of mine named Mike Charles, who's a detective here in Manhattan. And he was my technical advisor on the Thomas Crown Affair. And in the course of working with him for 6 months on that project, I got to know him, and I obviously got to do a lot of research with the guys that he was working with and spend a lot of time with them. But Mike's personal life, as it existed about five or seven years previous to my having met him, was much more interesting to me than just Mike as a current New York City detective, because back then he was drinking and popping pills and cheating on his wife, and at the same time, you know, was not in his own estimation, but by the guys who worked with him, considered to be one of the best cops in the city and one of the most active guys on duty. Like, he never took vacation. He was constantly consumed by the job. And I just thought, well, this is a really screwed up, messy guy who it must have been really funny to try to keep all that stuff going. And that's what we set out to do, was to kind of display as much of a real detective's life as we could on television. So, and I can't believe network TV's letting us get away with it, so.
Is Mike Charles flattered that Mike McNeil, your character, is based on him?
I think to begin with, I told him I was going to write a project about a detective. So he told me stories, and he opened up the doors to his friends and the guys in his squad and the women and had them tell us stories. So I think he thought we were going to come back with something other than what we came back with, because when he finally realized I was going to be writing about his life, he was kind of taken aback. And then I think when he was waiting for a pilot script to come in, he was still thinking it was going to be about a kind of a heroic, you know, New York TV cop. And instead it was really kind of spot on in terms of the details of his life. So he was like, well, man, my ex-wife's going to kill me. I was like, well, that's kind of the point, Mike. You know. So then I think once we got the cast together and he started to see, and Peter Toland came on board and he started to see where we were headed, I think it's like everything else, that like with the network. We are fine as long as we're funny. We can get away with anything as long as we're funny. And that's, I mean, some of the stuff we do is shocking language-wise or behavior-wise, but it's as long as it's making people laugh, then we know it's okay, because that's what we set out to do, is to be truthful and being truthful to be funny.
You know how in most TV series about cops, there's at least one episode in which an actor comes to work with the cops because the actor's going to play a cop, and the actor has to figure out what it's like to be a cop. And all the cops in the TV series think that the actor is really obnoxious and spoiled and too much like a fashion model.
Yeah.
Were you worried that you would come off as like the annoying actor visiting the real cops when you were working on the Thomas Crown Affair and you first met Mike Charles?
No, because I actually had, there was another project, a movie that I was getting ready to start called Double Whammy. And that was a film that was written to be directed by Tom DiCillo, who was a friend of mine. He's a guy who did Living in Oblivion and Box of Moonlight. And
The Real Blonde.
Yeah, and The Real Blonde. And he had done research with this guy who was a friend of his, who was also a detective in Manhattan, who I had been working with. So I felt like I didn't even want to meet Mike Charles, because I already had done research with Tom on this film that we were about to start, the Double Whammy, and I didn't want to waste the time in meeting and getting to know another guy. But John McTiernan, the director of Thomas Crown Affair, said, no, I insist that you meet this guy, because I think you're going to really hit it off with him. And, of course, the first time I met Mike, I really hit it off with him. And then something just caught my eye. He was very funny. He was very fast-talking. He was, very upfront. And when I met the crew that he worked with, I was really enthralled, because they were an interesting group of people and really, really funny. But then when I went out with these guys to see how they work together, it was, you know, the conversations in the car while they're killing time, which is a lot of what being a detective is about, were hysterical. So I was desperate to get it on paper, you know.
What kind of editing did you get, or at the network? Did you have to clear the scripts with Standards and Practices? Practices still exist.
Yeah, you have to go through that process. But I think because of Peter's history in television, he worked on Larry Sanders and a number of television series before that. He kind of knows how to get around them a little bit. Plus, they're kind of afraid of Peter and I, because there's so much that's not supposed to be in a half-hour show, a sitcom, so to speak. In our scripts, that they don't know where to start sometimes. And a lot of the times we get stuff that we just put down the way we want to portray it. And we know that they're going to try to take something away.
Dennis Leary is my guest, and he's the star, co-creator, co-writer of the series The Job. And the final episode, at least the final episode of this season, is next week. Most of us knew you first as a stand-up comic through your show No Cure for Cancer and from your MTV stand-up spots. Had you intended originally to act or to do comedy?
I went to school to become an actor and a writer. And then, you know, once I graduated, I went to Emerson College up in Boston. Once I graduated, you know, it's pretty obvious. I think it's probably the same way now. There's not a lot of work for actors and writers. And then Stephen Wright, the comedian who went to school with me at Emerson, had started doing stand-up, which was extraordinary because he was one of the most shy, painfully shy human beings on the planet. And Lenny Clark, who's in my show, the television show The Job, who plays Frank Harrigan, Lenny started going up on stage. This is like 1980, I guess, or 81. And I went and I saw those guys, and I thought, well, if they can do it, I can do it, you know? And, of course, I tried and failed desperately, and I spent another 3 or 4 years trying to get acting work. And then finally I just said, I'm just going to try this thing because I'll have some stage time, you know. So by the time I hit, it was hard to convince people, no, I can act. I've got a background in acting, and that was my the tough part of the first part of my career. I mean, I can remember even after we got after we did The Ref, we got some great reviews, but we also got a lot of, you know, knee-jerk critics who were astounded that, you know, this MTV stand-up comedian had been paired with the great theatrical actor Kevin Spacey and the Oscar-nominated Judy Davis, because that's they have to pigeonhole you somehow, you know.
Well, I want to talk about your persona in your stand-up act in No Cure for Cancer, and in your MTV spots. I mean, you were this really like loud, in your face, you know, often obnoxious personality. let me play a little clip from No Cure for Cancer.
We live in a country where John Lennon takes 6 bullets in the chest. Yoko Ono was standing right next to him. Not one f***ing bullet. Explain that to me. Explain it to me, God. Explain it to me, God. I want it explained to me now. Jesus. Now we got 25 more years. Yeah, I'm real f***ing happy now, God. I'm wearing a huge happy hat. Jesus Christ. I mean, Steve Ray Vaughan is dead, and we can't get John Bon Jovi in a helicopter. Come on, folks. Get on that helicopter, John. Shut the f*** up and get on that helicopter. There's a hairdresser in there. Yeah, go ahead in there. Yeah, yeah. I don't get it. You know, I just don't get it. I missed the point someplace. The boat left, and I wasn't on the boat. Explain it to me. Heavy metal bands on trial because kids commit suicide? What is that about? Judas Priest on trial because my kid bought the record and he listened to the lyrics and he got into straight. Well, that's great. That sets a legal precedent. Does that mean I can sue Dan Fogelberg for making me into a pussy in the mid-70s? Is that possible? Huh?
Dennis Leary, can you talk about the persona you created for the stand-up act and how, if at all, that coincides with who you were at the time?
Well, I do... For stage, both with No Cure for Cancer and my last one-man show, which was Lock and Load, I create the material from bullet points of ideas that I have written down in a notebook, and I have to get up on stage and sort of improv and talk them out loud over and over again. And then from there, after a couple of months of doing it, I start to create what is, I guess, a fairly scripted performance in my head, even though it's never put down on paper. So with No Cure for Cancer, because I knew I wanted to do a show that was about death in all its forms, in order to be really comfortable on stage when you're creating it, you have to feel like you're in your living room talking to your friends on a roll, so to speak. And so I ramped it up a little bit in No Cure for Cancer because the show was so full of violent, rapid-fire imagery and discussions about, you know, pop culture and death in general. I mean, Lock and Load, there's still a lot of, you know, fast-paced talking. That's the way I talk when I get going. But it's just the way it comes out of my head, you know. And that's just, you know, it's like Chris Rock says about his, when he talks about his wife in his stand-up act, he says, you know, there's my comedy wife and then there's my real-life wife, you know. So I think you want to feel like you're in the living room talking to your friends, but at the same time, you know, I happen to be a guy who talks very fast, and I get very angry about certain issues, and, you know, sometimes people who know me really well, if they're driving in the car with me and I get upset about something, it could seem to them like I was the stand-up comedy guy or the No Cure for Cancer guy, whatever you want to call it. But I'm obviously not like that all the time.
What about figuring out where the line is between, you know, something that you could say on stage and something that's in such bad taste that you wouldn't say it?
I don't think there is a line, but I think there's a line as regards certain certain events. You know, I never personally to this day found a way to make, for instance, the death of Eric Clapton's son. That never was funny to me. It still isn't funny to me. Whereas, you know, talking about, I don't know why, about John Lennon being assassinated in No Cure for Cancer, that was funny.
Did Yoko ever write to you and say, how could you have said that about me?
No, I've never actually met Yoko. I've seen her. I have friends who live in the Dakota, so I've seen her from a distance here and there. I know I've run into many people over the years that I discussed in my stand-up shows. So
and you're still alive, so it couldn't be too bad.
Well, I mean, it's, if you don't have a sense of humor about it, you know, then I'm just going to make fun of you again. You know what I mean? That's the way. I mean, everybody's if you're a public figure, especially, obviously, you're up for grabs. You know.
My guest is comic and actor Dennis Leary. He's the co-creator and star of the ABC detective series, The Job. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Leary is my guest, and he's the star and co-creator of the TV series The Job. The final episode, at least the final episode of this season, is next week. In No Cure for Cancer, you tell a story about your father having a carpentry accident when you were 10, and he kind of saws off his thumb. His thumb's hanging by a thread.
Yeah.
He tapes it back onto his hand, drives himself to the hospital where it gets repaired. Did you think that that's how you were going to be, too?
No, I thought my father was some kind of a superhero, which I guess is what probably all boys think about their dads. But he was, you know, it was also that generation of men from...
What, stoic?
You know, they were like John, they looked at John Wayne as sort of like their, you know, their be-all and end-all. My father was a... you know, an Irish immigrant who came to this country, you know, the old cliche in 1950 or 51 with no money in his pockets. And he came to New York and, you know, started to make his living. So it's hard for me to look at my dad and not really admire everything that he made out of his life. Cause he basically, the day that one of my sisters was born, he was at work and they called and said my mother was at the hospital going into labor. And he drove to the downtown to where the hospital was, and parked at a meter and had no money. He was waiting, you know, paycheck to paycheck. And he got out of the car and he thought, well, I'm going to have to make do with a ticket here because I can't, you know, I have no change to put into this meter. And he looked down and he was stepping on a $5 bill. And I've always remembered that story as being like evident of my dad's approach to life, which is that, you know, you have the luck of the Irish, something good will happen. You just keep moving forward, moving forward, moving forward, you know.
Why did he come to the country when he did?
Because then, back then, you know, at that time, he came from a huge family, and his mother died giving birth to the last child, and all they had was the family farm, and, you know, not everybody was going to be able to make a living off of that farm. It was going to have to be given to the oldest boy. So he had to come here to make money because it wasn't, you know, there was no economic boom in those days in Ireland. He came, and not only did he end up making a living, but he got us fed and clothed, and we all had college education. So, you know.
What kind of job did he have?
He was a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
He was a car nut.
You went to Catholic school?
Yeah.
For all of your school year?
12 years.
Wow.
Yep, same school, same nuns, same priests.
Were you afraid of the nuns? Do you think you were any more or less afraid of the nuns than you would have been of lay teachers?
We were more afraid of the nuns than we were of the priests, except there was one priest, the headmaster, Father Reynolds, who, when you were young, you were afraid of him because he was a real tough guy. He was an ex-boxer who grew up in the neighborhood and became a priest and then the headmaster of the school. But the nuns were, to this day, you know, I had one great nun, Sister Rosemary Sullivan, who passed away last year, and she was the one who first put me into a play in high school, and she was the nun who told me about Emerson College, which, you know, saved my life because that's where I basically learned everything I know about acting and writing. So,
did you have to get disciplined a lot? And what was the discipline?
Yeah, I was a terrible
discipline?
Student. Terrible.
Uh-huh. What kind of punishments were you subjected to?
Oh, well, you know, we had the nuns used to love to hit you on the knuckles with a ruler, and it got to the point. I mean, they would just whack you in the head. You know, this is back in the days when they were allowed to hit you without being taken to court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. But I look back on it, and I'm really glad because that kind of repression where, you know, you're always in a situation where you're not supposed to be laughing just leads to more laughter. I mean, some of my fondest memories are my friends and my cousins and my brothers and sisters. We're just, you know, laughing because you're not supposed to, whether it was in church or school or, you know.
Were you at all religious during that period when you were in Catholic school?
Well, we were forced to be, you know, we had to go to Mass every Sunday, and then eventually you got $200 taken off your tuition if you were in the altar boys or the choir. So that was, you know, a lot of money for my parents. So I was kicked out of the altar boys and then kicked out of the choir boys. I'm kind of proud of that.
What were you kicked out for?
Altar boys for drinking the holy wine
yeah.
before the mass started, just to see what it tasted like. And I was told that was a mortal sin and I was going to hell. So that at that point, I was like, well, if I'm already going, I might as well just take as many people with me as I can. And then I went into the choir boys to try to get that money taken off of the tuition again. And I think I got kicked out of the choir boys because, and I'm not trying to point the finger. Somebody was smoking and they passed me the cigarette. I had never actually took a hit off the cigarette, but it was right at the moment when the choir director turned around and caught us. So,
well, I'll point out you've taken hits off of plenty of cigarettes since then.
Oh yeah.
You know, as a former altar boy and choir boy, are you surprised by the sexual scandals in the church now?
No, as a matter of fact, Lock and Load ended the HBO version and the record. Both ended with a kind of a hip-hop track with me live talking over it about sexual abuse by priests of kids. That was 1997. So, you know, I've been a vocal advocate of leaving the Catholic Church or having them fix themselves for years.
But you still like the schooling that you had?
I really love it. I came from a neighborhood school. You know, I walked to school every day. It was about a block and a half, two blocks from my apartment. All the kids I grew up with, we all went to school together for 12 years. We felt like we were a big gang, and
right.
we felt like, you know, we knew how to handle, like, the nuns and the priests in terms of what we had to do and what we didn't have to do to get by. But I loved it because it was like I grew up in a neighborhood where you could, you know, you could basically walk anywhere. And we loved playing sports and we loved, you know, everything about our school. And we kind of knew by the time we were, you know, 14 or 15 that we weren't buying into what what they were teaching us anymore in terms of religion. We were just getting through until we went to college, you know.
Dennis Leary is the co-creator and star of the ABC detective comedy The Job. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. Also by Audi. In performance, technology, and design, the goal remains constant, never follow. Information available at audiusa.com. And Harcourt, publisher of The Middle of Everywhere, The World's Refugees Come to Our Town, Stories from the Frontline of Refugee Life in America by Mary Pfeiffer. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Sonics, a very early punk band. Also, Daniel Harris talks about his un-memoir, a memoir of no one in particular. And we continue our conversation with actor and comic Dennis Leary. Well, last time I saw my baby, she was waving me goodbye. Then when she kissed me, I thought that I'm gonna cry. Ah! This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic and actor Dennis Leary. His ABC detective sitcom, The Job, has its final episode of the season next week. It may or may not be renewed. Leary first became known for his stand-up comedy show, No Cure for Cancer, and his short comic breaks on MTV. Before you developed your really kind of like sarcastic, loud, onstage stand-up persona, did you ever like sing in school versions of Broadway shows?
Well, yeah, that's what saved me, because I did that nun, Sister Rosemary, put me in when I was, I think I was 13. She forced me to be the kid in MAME, the musical. And I ended up thinking it was great because you got the afternoons off from school to rehearse,
uh-huh.
which was the reason I really liked it. And then I guess about probably 3 years later, she put me in another musical with a friend of mine who's a fireman now. And then by the time I started to realize I wasn't going to be a hockey player because, number one, I wasn't good enough, and number two, my grades were horrendous. I started to think, well, maybe I'll do this acting thing, because it was a great way to meet girls, which I discovered in high school. And I hated musicals. To this day, I'm not a guy that goes to see musicals. I thought it was always kind of strange that people just started singing out of the blue. You know, I could not get the non-reality of that out of my head. To me, a musical was like when I saw Help or Hard Day's Night, where the Beatles would be like characters, and then when it was time to play or sing, they'd walk over and pick up the instruments and start singing. You know what I mean? So, but it was a good thing, because it put the bug in my ear about acting.
In No Cure for Cancer, you talk about drugs, and you say, I did my share and your share.
Mm-hmm.
When was the period in your life when you were doing that?
Well, I was a teenager from 1970, well, the entire 70s, but I mean, I went to college from 75 to 79. I mean, that alone right there,
mm-hmm.
Growing up in that time period, especially with when punk and new wave hit, it was a completely different approach to life, I guess. But it's also part of growing up, and it's part of the rock and roll life as well. You know?
Well, what drugs most suited your personality?
Oh, God, none of them, quite frankly. The only thing I've found that suits my personality is beer, which I like. One thing I never did was, just from watching it from a fashion point of view and also from a practical point of view, I just never saw any reason to take acid or any kind of drug that would alter your mind like that. I didn't like the Grateful Dead. I didn't like the whole hippie thing, which I just missed in terms of fashion and music. And I just didn't appeal to me. So by the time, the kind of music I liked kicked in, which was the Ramones and the Clash and those fashions I liked as well, I was kind of like, thank God for that.
It sounds like you were afraid if you took acid, you'd suddenly be wearing like paisley
bell bottoms
or something.
Yeah, exactly. wearing a beard and listen to, I'll never forget the guy who was the keyboard player, and yes, Rick Wakeman put out a live double album of him playing the organ. And my brother and his friends used to sit around and listen to it. And I was like, this is a live double album of the organ player from Yes. I mean, this is really, we've reached the breaking point here, okay? I was glad I missed that boat.
So this is what you didn't want drugs to do, to turn you into a fan of that album.
Yeah, I remember that in my day, what we needed drugs for was to fuel us, to keep us up so that we could dance. And,
mm-hmm.
We would go to clubs to see bands and dance. So the whole, sort of double live album approach to life didn't suit. This is in the era when, Rick Wakeman was doing the double live album, but, Elvis Costello and The Clash were writing 3-minute songs. Much the same as kids growing up now. I mean, teenagers now would be, I guess, taking a lot of ecstasy. It's probably and the music they listen to reflects that as well. So it's,
When you broke into films after doing stand-up, pretty early on started making films with really great actors, De Niro,
yeah.
Kevin Spacey, Judy Davis. Recently you were directed by Joe Mantegna,
yes.
who I think is a terrific actor. Are there things that you've learned from, on the job working with great actors that go beyond what you learned when you were in school where you were getting your chops?
Definitely. And one of the things, I met De Niro fairly early on, he had come to see No Cure for Cancer, and he was trying to develop some, you know, younger talent through his company, Tribeca. So, and you know, he was obviously a hero of mine. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to act was when I saw Mean Streets the first time. It was the first time I thought at the movies, wow, I know guys like that. I could do this, you know.
So, what'd you ask De Niro?
Oh, I've asked him so many questions. It's over the years. It's not even. I have to. Right. I have to really think about that. But I mean, he's the kind of guy. He's got a big production company, and he's been at it for years. So he's a good source, as is his partner Jane Rosenthal. Is a good source of any kind of question, from financing to budget to location. I mean, it's all practical stuff, you know.
Now, I understand. After you leave the studio, you're going to throw out the first pitch at a Mets game.
Yeah. Kind of an astounding situation that the Mets have found themselves in. They've got possibly the Red Sox's biggest fan throwing out the first ball at their game. So, you know, it's ironic to me that I will be throwing out the first ball in on the same field where, you know, the Bill Buckner incident occurred.
You're not worried about, like, throwing a wild pitch or anything?
No, I was a little bit worried about that, but it's the whole cast of the show throwing out the first ball. So when you do that, they move you in closer to home plate. I'm more worried about just, I don't know. I would hate to. My instinct as a Red Sox fan is to do something that will make the crowd in the stands very upset. But I've been told I should shy away from that.
And after the Mets game, you're getting inducted into, what, the Museum of Television and Radio Hall of Fame?
Yeah, which is, you know, pretty amazing. But, that's going to be fun. It's fun. So no matter what happens with the show, in that building here in Manhattan, there will be a plaque and some photo of the cast for into perpetuity, you know?
Right.
So I'll be able to take my relatives and say, see, I had a TV show once.
Dennis Leary recorded yesterday. He is the co-creator and star of the ABC detective comedy The Job. The final episode of the season airs next week. Leary doesn't yet know if it will be renewed. In this scene from The Job, he and his buddies have been using a telescope to spy on a naked woman practicing yoga. When their view is blocked by furniture, they disguise themselves as building maintenance workers and go to her apartment.
I think, man, we definitely have to move this piece of furniture because it's blocking a vent and it's trapping fumes, and that's a very serious situation.
Has this been a problem for anyone else in the building?
Oh, yeah, a whole bunch of people. Yeah, you know the old lady upstairs?
Which one?
The old one with the gray hair and the really old face.
I haven't seen her for ages.
That's because she's dead. And we have reason to believe that her death was definitely fume-related, so... What do you know? What are the odds? There actually is a vent here.
I know. Well, that's quite an improvement. It really opens up the energy of the room.
We got to go up and do the heating element fixture thing on the 23rd floor.
Yep.
So thank you, and we will be in touch.
You're going up to the 23rd?
Yes, we got a thing to do up there.
This building only has 18 stories.
Right, right, but we have a code. We say 23, we mean 18. We always add 5 floors. So thank you.
Why?
I'm not really at liberty to tell you about that. It's a secret janitor thing. So thank you, and we'll talk to you later.
Coming up, a memoir of no one in particular. This is Fresh Air. Daniel Harris set out to write an anti-memoir, a book that would satirize the vogue for memoirs and probe the typical banalities of daily life. But he realized that little about his life is typical. He describes himself as an effete homosexual who spends 6 days of the week reading and writing, who lounges around for most of his waking hours in a house robe and pajamas, and who ekes out a subsistence living. His book turned into an unconventional memoir in which, as he puts it, he examines how his wardrobe and sex life have evolved, how his relationship to books has changed, and how he cannot lie with the same poetic license that made his childhood fibs so colorful. The book is called A Memoir of No One in Particular. I asked Daniel Harris to do a short reading and to introduce it for us.
My father was a therapist, a very liberal Jewish therapist. My mother was a disaffected Baptist director of a large daycare center. So they were both involved in social service organizations. And so they instilled in me really intensely democratic principles that were somehow at odds with my homosexuality. And that's what this passage is about. My parents' belief in the importance of social service organizations, along with the radicalism of the counterculture, fostered in me a fiercely egalitarian commitment to helping the poor and fighting for minority rights. My politics, however, simply did not jibe with an aspect of my life that pulled me in exactly the opposite direction, my homosexuality. I grew up taunted by the very people I now hope to serve, the sons of Wisconsin farmers, gang members in Buffalo, and rednecks in Appalachia, bigots whose scorn I met halfway with my own contempt, a self-protective superciliousness I cultivated by embracing the very things my peers despised, most notably literature and art. I became a snob, an elitist, a dandy who, during one mercifully brief period in early adolescence, adopted a cane, and during a much longer period, in fact for the rest of my life, a faint British accent. But at the same time that I was looking down my nose at the unwashed masses, I was kissing their children, malnourished six-year-olds who came to the daycare center starving, with black eyes, distended bellies, and rotten teeth. Early in my adolescence, I was torn between the political lessons of equality that were a key part of my moral education and my survival tactics as an effeminate teenager, my use of books, culture, and an air of sophistication to project the kind of power my heterosexual schoolmates found on the basketball court and the football field.
You say in your book that that as a kid you used to listen to tapes of your voice and kind of ran the self-imposed language lab. What did you hear when you listened back to your voice when you were young?
I'm not sure that I really remember what I heard. We moved from Wisconsin, a small town in Wisconsin, to Asheville, North Carolina. And we had visited several times before we moved down there, and I got one. I heard the Appalachian accent, which is not one of these luscious, deep southern brogues. So I brought with me a tape of all of the vowel sounds and the consonants and a few key sentences that I played back, and so that I would not get a southern accent. And I was just determined not to get a southern accent. And I did succeed. But what I have created is really artificial, as one can tell, a very artificial kind of delivery. And I do not have a southern accent. My accent is not like my parents. So where did it come from? And I think that the answer is that it came from popular culture, which is one of the ways that homosexuals did create their sensibility and their demeanor, is by imitating the false Brahmins of old Hollywood films, who do speak oddly enough, even though they live in California and were born in the Bronx, they all speak with a refined British accent. And I adopted this refined British accent straight off of the silver screen.
You devote a chapter of your memoir to lying. What kinds of things did you once lie about?
Well, when I was a child, I took real poetic license and lied in very extravagant ways. In fact, one of the most embarrassing lies I made was it started in I don't know what grade. I was very young, and other kids were getting glasses, and my vision was perfect, absolutely perfect. There was nothing I could do. So I decided I would feign that I failed the eye exam. Well, I did fail the first eye exam. I was taken to a specialist. I gave such erratic, such inconsistent responses that I was taken to yet another optometrist, and finally was taken out of state to a specialist who exposed me and said, "You're lying." And all I was trying to do, at first, all I wanted was glasses, but it acquired a kind of momentum because I was so thrilled by being this dying Camille character with a tragic illness, and that I would be blinded by the time I was 15. So it was really an attempt to create for myself, which is, I think, what this book is about, an alternative identity, an identity I did not have. But I think that really through lying, you create a sort of mobility to get out of circumstances that you shouldn't be in or you don't want to be in.
You spend most days working home alone.
Right.
Writing, reading. And the book that you've just written is a book all about yourself. Mm-hmm. Because it's a memoir that details the objects and habits of your daily life. So what do you do to prevent an unhealthy level of self-absorption?
It's true. This book is really navel-gazing, taken to a unnatural extreme. But who says that my life is not pathologically self-absorbed? I am pathologically self-absorbed. And the one thing that I feel is that I am somebody, as I've mentioned, who considers himself no one in particular. I was self-created. I did not have, myself did not come out of my religion or my family or the community I lived in. It doesn't come out of my job. All of the things in my life, all of the structure in my life is self-imposed. I have created this vast edifice of habits that from getting up in the morning to when I go to the gym in the afternoon to what I do at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And it is really an attempt to create a structure in a life that has no structure whatsoever. And I could easily simply put down my pen and never pick it up again. And I can assure you nobody would make too many complaints about me having done that. So it's all really my own initiative, this life. It's extremely... it's very taxing. And one of the things that I find about my the solitary nature of my life is that because it is the creation of this edifice of habits, the habits become very self-punishing. And I really am a taskmaster in fulfilling them. If I do not go to the gym in the afternoon, I am miserable that evening. So there, and if I gain 2 or 3 pounds, I'm miserable about it. So that these habits really have acquire a life of their own in a life that emerges out of a kind of vacuum, as mine does.
Your memoir ends with you saying that you've retreated to a somewhat tragic view of life. In what sense?
I think that I was a child. I was a bright kid, and I got, you know, I was always in the 99.9 percentile of all of the tests, and I was told I could be anything I wanted to be. My father was a psychologist who really was very heavily influenced by the human potential movement and the notion that one can achieve anything. And as I have grown older, I've realized how false that promise is, that that I cannot, for instance... I have never achieved my aspirations of securing a readership for my writing. I have no control over these things. It is the book is partly a rediscovery of these absolutes in a culture that purveys myths about the omnipotence of the individual.
So how old are you?
I am now 44. When I finished the book, I was 43. Mm-hmm. I used to have a stage age, though.
A stage age?
Yes, I did used to cut years off of my life. Especially, you know, not necessarily with men, but with editors. That's how oddly ambitious I was, because it was very, very difficult for me to relinquish the myth of precocity that haunts contemporary culture, that I think is really, I've learned... is a kind of marketing ploy, an attempt to create the illusion that a publisher is publishing the latest writer, the writer of the future. And as I've become older and older and never qualified for the writer of the future, I have become very, very skeptical about the notion of precocity and precocious writers. I think that writers have the apprenticeship for a writer is 10 or 20 years. I don't think writers become good writers in their 20s.
So you have to find a way of being comfortable with the fact that you're not the young next hot thing.
That's right. I'm an old hot thing. I'm the oldest living hottish thing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Harris is the author of A Memoir of No One in Particular. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the proto-punk band The Sonics. This is Fresh Air. There was a British music press headline from the 1960s that read, "Would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone?" But compared to the wild punk rockers who ruled the Pacific Northwest, the Stones were pussycats, says Ed Ward, who thinks that letting the daughter marry a Stone would be far preferable to her marrying a member of Tacoma's wild band, the Sonics.
When we talk about punk rock, we should remember that the term was invented by writer Billy Altman in the early 70s, well before the Ramones came onto the scene. He was describing a type of music which flourished in a number of different places in America, like Minneapolis, Chicago, Texas, and particularly the Pacific Northwest. Many bands came and went, but probably the greatest of them all were the Sonics. The Sonics were high school kids from Tacoma, Washington, and formed around 1963 to play teen dances, inspired by the area's other highly successful band, the Wailers. Soon, they were playing all over the Northwest in Washington and Oregon, moving from the teen clubs to actual rock concerts. Naturally, they wanted to make a single, so they piled into a studio and cut The Witch. Because they had no idea if they'd get another chance, on the B-side, they added another classic. We'll be right back. Originally in 1966, they went into the studio to make an album for their label, Etiquette, which was owned by one of the Wailers, their idols. They recorded a lot of other people's songs, unsure that their originals were any good at all. Silly kids. Waiting is one of the evilest of the Sonics songs. Who's waiting? Why, Satan, of course, who punishes all girlfriends who stray. The song showcases Rob Lynn's throat-shedding vocals, a style used by a lot of Northwest groups, but none ever did it better. Sonic's boom was the result, one of the highest energy albums ever released in this country, until the double Detroit punch of the MC5 and the Stooges. With radio still being largely regional, the Sonics hit big on their home turf, as well as Cleveland and Pittsburgh, but never really made the national scene. Eventually, between the British invasion and psychedelica, their hard-edged style fell out of favor, members left the band, and eventually they disappeared, reuniting for a legendary show in 1972. They may never have become the stars they deserve to become, but they're still revered by musicians to this day.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Schurach. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of A Cup of Light by Nicole Moens, a novel set in modern China by the author of Lost in Translation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. The Last Waltz, the movie about the final concert of the band, is back in theaters. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Levon Helm and Robbie Robertson. Join us